This week on Writers, Inc.
But as far as books go, yes, my process has changed dramatically. What I do now is I write the book, my books, as scripts first. Not with any intention of selling them to movies or television. I do it to get the story out as fast as I can.
J.K. Rowling was nearly homeless when she wrote the first Harry Potter book. Stephen King penned Carrie in a small desk wedged between a washer and dryer. James Patterson worked in advertising and famously crafted the Toys R Us theme song long before becoming an author. Join New York Times bestseller J.D. Barker and a panel of industry powerhouses as they pull back the curtain on some of the world's most prolific authors. Where did they start? What is their process? The biggest names in publishing all have origin stories, all have tips and secrets. What does it take to consistently top the bestseller lists and become a household name? Get your notepad out. School's in session. This is Writers, Inc.
Hi, I'm Christine Daigle.
I'm Jenna Brown.
I'm Kevin Tomlinson.
And I'm J.D. Barker. Welcome to Writers, Inc. I just heard there's a horror cafe in Vegas.
There is. There is.
And let's emphasize that. Horror. It's a horror cafe.
Right. Horror.
Because I was completely disappointed when I found out that I was pronouncing it wrong.
Well, there are those cafes here too, if you know where to look.
That's a whole different part of the city, I think.
But that's a different conversation. Yeah, it's actually right fairly close to the Horseshoe too, where we'll all be in November. It's just a little cafe, but it's really cool. They have, like, you know, the Shining Twins down this, like, backlit red hall going to the bathroom, and all these different like murals on the wall with just all like massive horror characters. So it's really cool. It's really cool.
Didn't Universal just open a giant haunted house there too?
Like they right did. On the strip? Yeah.
What?
Yeah. It's the biggest theme park not attached to a theme park, I guess, is how they described it.
I think we need to go there.
Yeah, that would be
great. I'm thinking I got to change my flight and get in a couple days early just so I can try all these things.
Yeah, it's supposed to be really fun. And then in that same, that whole area now of Vegas is actually really cool, like, because they have that Area 15, which has like the Omega Mart, and then they have like a John Wick experience. Yeah. So you can like actually like go through and be
fun.
Part of a movie. And yeah, like they're really kind of going all in on the experience. Elements. Which
I want to kill someone with a book. Do they let you do that?
I don't know.
My John Wick dream.
I think you
don't have to go to Vegas for that.
And we should see.
Oh, perfect. Yeah, we're gonna do that.
Cool. Start putting an agenda together.
Yeah.
All right, Kevin. What is in the news?
Oh, in the news. So Kindle Translate Beta. Amazon is now actively rolling out an AI-powered translation program directly inside Kindle Direct Publishing for select authors. Amazon is positioning translation as a one-click scalability tool for indie authors, potentially allowing books to rapidly enter the international market without traditional human translation costs. This could dramatically increase the volume of translated books on Kindle, especially in genres where rapid release strategies already dominate. It also raises quality and rights questions. AI translation may work well for straightforward prose, but voice-heavy literary fiction, humor, poetry, and culturally nuanced writing could suffer. From a business perspective, this is another sign Amazon wants authors to stay entirely inside its ecosystem.
So I got this email yesterday and I had a bunch of questions, but being lazy like I am, yeah. I didn't bother to look up any of the answers. So I did figure out, it looks like this is only two languages straight off the bat, German and Spanish.
Yeah.
You know, don't quote me on that because I might be wrong. Did anybody see how long your book has to be enrolled for? You know, like KDP is 90 days, which isn't that bad. You know, typically with translations, like I've used translation services before, and a lot of them will tie up your book for, you know, 3, 4, 5 years, you know, before you can get your rights back. Like it's because there's so much time and money involved in creating that translation. You know, they need to hold on to it for a while. Now, obviously, this is being done by AI, so, you know, that changes the whole dynamic. But I'm curious how long your book actually has to stay in it.
It's a good question. Everything else they do is 90 days, even the audiobook stuff.
Yeah, it's 90 days.
Well, actually, no, I don't think there's any.
It's 90 days.
It is 90 days.
Okay. Yeah.
I think that quality is an issue. I mean, even even outside of literary prose, which, like kind of the metaphor and stuff might get lost in translation. But like, do you trust it even just to not make mistakes on straightforward prose? Like, I don't know that I would. Like, how do you know if it's right?
I don't know that there's even a
Yeah.
thing as straightforward prose.
Yeah.
You know, like,
Yeah.
you know, in my 4MK trilogy, I've got a lot of humor, but it's dark humor, and a lot of it is very subtle. So, like, translating humor into another language is extremely difficult, you know, because it could be a word that's,
Yeah.
you know, that causes it or whatever. But, like, you need somebody who can actually make that judgment call. And I've experienced, like, in real life, like, The Fourth Monkey's been a bestseller in pretty much every country it's ever landed in, except for Italy. In Italy, it completely tanked, and we've since learned it was because of the translation. And that was a human translator, you know, but it can make or break a book, you know, so AI could do the same thing. But you know, the other half of my mind is saying Amazon's not going to let that happen on this, not straight out of the gate. So I'm guessing that they're going to have safeguards in place, at least at the very beginning, to make sure the books that they initially start with are translated very well, because they're going to want to get that 5-star rating themselves on this thing as a process. Because if, you know, the books come out and they're garbage, you know, everybody's gonna shoot, you know, gonna crap on it, and then it's
Yeah.
gone.
I wonder if
Yeah.
that means, like, do they have people actually like quality checking the
That's what I was
translation?
getting at. I think they have to. Like, they're, you know, you can have an AI check an AI, and I know a lot of authors are doing that with translations. You know, they're running it through 4 or 5 different ones, trying to weed the stuff out. But at the end of the day, you need somebody that can speak the language to really go through it. That's the only way you're going to know for sure.
Yeah, and things that are like culturally, that we take for granted don't exist in other cultures, right? I remember when we were doing
Yeah.
Heavier the Stones, two translators reached out to me about the same thing. It was just like two words, and they're like, "What does this mean?" And I was like, "Oh." But I, one of my friends who was from Venezuela was talking about Shrek, and they did the interpretation for the gingerbread man. You remember that guy with his little gumdrop buttons? And it was like, "Do you know the Muffin Man? The Muffin Man? The Muffin Man?" They don't have that. Like, that's not a thing. So they had translated to like, "Do you wash with soap and water? Soap and water, soap and water." So it was just like a meme going on because they had literally no translation for this, so I had to come up with something. But I'm just like, things we take for granted don't
Yeah.
translate to other languages, right? So that's all.
That's true.
Yeah.
Yeah. They actually have the makings of everything they would need to do this well with by crowdsourcing it to maybe their Kindle Unlimited subscribers to help them sort this out. They could do a select announcement to certain Kindle users who read, you know, the genre in that language and
Hopefully, yeah.
say, "We're trying to perfect this. This is experimental. There may be glitches and typos. We need you to point it out to us." They could do that and save themselves a bunch of overhead and perfect this a lot faster. But it's Amazon, so they won't.
I just think it's ironic that, it's like AI, but it's still very people-centric. Like, so just pay the people to do the, but it's fine.
Yeah.
Let's move on.
All right. ChatGPT now makes book recommendations. ChatGPT states, share a few of your favorite books to get a personalized list of recommendations. ChatGPT can look for patterns in the books you like, then turn them into sh a short reading list with why each recommendation fits your taste. So now we're outsourcing
Well, but
book
my
recommendations.
biggest question here is AI has cutoff dates. Like, it doesn't know.
Like the last couple of years, right?
Yeah, so
Is that still happening though, or
I don't
is it
know.
current? Because I think Claude is current now. Like, Claude was, you know, like 2 years behind, you know, 4 or 5 months ago or whatever, but I'm pretty sure that it's up to speed.
I don't know, but I know that it does still have some limitations because, like, well, I don't know. I don't know.
Well, I mean, if you take a step back, you have to look at, you know, like, how is the AI going to discover books? I know it's got a
Yeah.
plugin for Shopify, so that's probably going to be a huge crutch that they're going to lean on for that. At the end of the day, though, I think it's going to do it the same way that, you know, everything else has done it, which is going to be an internet search. You know, so if your books are making a lot of noise, you know, if there's a lot of stuff written about them, that's how it's going to discover them. That's how it's going to determine what's popular and what's not. You know, so I think doubling down on that can't go wrong. I mean, like my books are already in there and I didn't do anything specific to make that happen. So that means that it's just doing a regular web crawl to come up with data. But mm-hmm. I do think that they're going to find some way to use the Shopify thing and exploit that and use it.
Probably. Mm-hmm. I mean, I clicked the link and it just takes you to a prompt, but I didn't respond to the prompt. So I was just curious what it was going to be. But yeah, it's just asking you to talk about, what is it? Help me find my next favorite book in a few words. Ask me to share 3 to 5 of my favorite books.
I mean, this is the future, yeah. though. I mean, like, even if you look at Google, you know, 2 months ago when you did a Google search, or let's go back 6 months ago, and you just got straight links to other web pages that satisfy the query, then, you know, they updated to this other thing where now you've got an AI response at the top that kind of summarizes stuff. Mm-hmm. Now they changed it again, and I don't know if you've seen this, but now you get an AI window. So you get the AI summary, and then it keeps you in the AI like prompting system, so you can ask questions of the AI, and you have to actually close out of that to get to the links behind it. So like they are gradually moving everybody towards that, you know, that singular AI response.
Yeah, it was interesting because in those Google Now AI searches, my son was looking for jobs and was looking for something specific, and it came up with the one that looked awesome, but it was like, apply at this site. I've never heard of this site, and I'm like, maybe just look that up. And it was like a scam job site. That was like top three that the AI pulled up. So you have to be careful with that.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I guess in the same way that you had to get good at Google.
Yeah.
You know, because there was an art before, you know, Google broke. There was an art to getting like good search results. You know, otherwise it would just give you kind of the same old, like most popular things. You kind of had to learn how to fine tune it. I guess it'll be the same thing here. I don't know.
I don't know. The AI story.
Let's continue on with AI.
All right. Speaking of stories and AI, John Grisham's new legal drama is a real-life fight against AI audiobooks on YouTube. AI-generated pirate audiobooks are becoming a new copyright problem for publishers. People are uploading unauthorized AI-narrated versions of best-selling books like those by John Grisham to platforms like YouTube and racking up huge view counts. Current copyright detection tools were built for matching official audio recordings, not AI-generated readings of the same text. That means these fake audiobooks can slip through automated systems even when they clearly violate copyright. The YouTube video for Grisham's book, The Widow, has been up for 6 months and has accumulated almost 100,000 views from Kevin Tomlinson. I mean, on their own. Publishers may now face a whack-a-mole problem, manually issuing takedowns one by one while new AI audiobook copies keep appearing almost instantly.
Wow.
Can I ask a stupid question? Because I don't actually know how YouTube works, but like, can't YouTube just make a thing where, like, you can't make money on views until you verify that, like, it's your content? Like, isn't there a way to do that? Yeah. Like,
that's
just
a good idea. I don't know what's going on exactly with YouTube, but I know that recently they've been changing some things, and it's causing a lot of problems. And one of those has been they have this authenticity rule now. That the content has to be authentic, and the people getting caught up in this and getting their entire channels canceled are all original creators who aren't even using AI, or if they are using AI, it's to generate, you know, video over their voiceover for their written script or something. So the problem with YouTube is that they are constantly implementing these things, and it doesn't matter who gets hurt by it. So I can only imagine the nightmare that would come with having to pre-vet or pre-verify your content ahead of time. I think there would be entire channels that got shut down before they ever got a start, frankly. What?
At the end of the day, I mean, if you look at it, YouTube is owned by Google, right? So Google is, you know, they're monetizing those links, they're monetizing the activity. Every time you look at something, whether it's legitimate or illegal, they're making money from that. So until somebody else shuts it down, they have no incentive to shut it down. So honestly, I think the real solution, and this probably won't happen, is they have to go after Google. The search engines themselves and YouTube and the platforms need to be held accountable for the content that they're putting up. I think if it starts hitting them in the wallet, that's the only way this is going to change.
Yeah.
It's not an easy problem to solve, It's not going to be an easy problem to solve. We're going to see a lot. We're going to be reading a lot more stories like this in the near future. And that's it for the news.
Yay. Okay. On that happy note, JD, who is up this week?
So if you heard me talk about this guy last week, I am still trying to figure out who he is. So it's Lee Goldberg. If you read any of his bios, like every bio on every site is different. And he says he's everything from an ex-Navy SEAL to a neuropsychologist or whatever, like he's throwing everything at the wall. But best I can tell, he's a television writer. He's been working in the industry for a very long time. He's worked on some very, very cool, iconic shows back in the day. And he writes a lot of books. His latest one is called Murder by Design, a thriller, and it releases on June 1st. So here he is, Lee Goldberg.
Thank you so much for being here.
It's my pleasure. Anything to get away from my writing for a few minutes. Any excuse.
Yes, I understand that. And I am delighted to help you in your procrastination.
Procrastination is my middle name, right next to dashing and modest.
Yes, I think I saw that, actually. I had a really great time reading your new book, and we will definitely be diving into Mr. Bixby and Mr. Nash shortly. But before we get there, we kind of like to go all the way to the start and find out, what's your writer origin story? How'd you get started?
Well, it's quite an origin story. The basics are, writing has always been in my household. My mother was a journalist and a print journalist, and my father was an anchorman on the local television station. And he talked like this all the time with the same insincere smile on his face that I have right now. Now, you're laughing because you only have to hear this voice for about 5 seconds. Imagine if your entire life, your father, at all times, talked to you like there was a camera in the house. And he was delivering the news. And when he laughed like this. So I never knew if my dad actually found me amusing or not. When I was in high school, I started contributing articles to a local newspaper. And I was able to do interviews with big name television producers over the phone because I could do my dad's voice. They didn't know I was a 15, 16 year old kid.
Oh my gosh.
And I went to UCLA and put myself through school writing about the entertainment and publishing industries for various newspapers and magazines, mostly phone interviews, so no one knew just how young I was. And neither did the editors that I was sending these articles to in New York City. And I had a journalism professor at UCLA who wrote conspiracy thrillers and international spy novels and all that. And he would show me his manuscripts and I would give him advice. Even though I'd never traveled internationally, and had very little sex, I had lots of opinions on international travel and sex and spying. And I was an expert on everything. And one day he was offered by his publisher a contract to write men's action adventure novels, which were, this is the early 80s, sort of the male equivalent of the Harlequin romance, with titles like The Executioner, The Destroyer, The Drooler, The Defecator, The Masturbator. They all had ER, OR at the end, and big muscled guys on the cover, and big guns, and women with giant breasts and explosions. And you found them at finer 7-Elevens and military bases around the country.
Yes.
In fact, here's the cover from one of them. I'm getting ahead of my story, but I'll tell you in a second. And he said he wasn't hungry enough, stupid enough, or desperate enough to write one of these books, but he knew somebody who was. And he offered me the contract, and I was 18 years old, 19 years old. So I wrote this book called 357 Vigilante by Ian Ludlow. So I'd be on the shelf next to Robert Ludlum, who is then the biggest selling writer in the world. And his covers are really boring. They were, Brandenburg Gate and Doric Columns. I have explosions and Hooters. And Ian for Ian Fleming. So people would go, Ian Ludlow. I think I read something by him and it wasn't bad.
Yeah.
Well, my book came out the same week as Bernard Goetz blew away some muggers on New York subway train. Vigilantes were hot. New World Pictures bought the movie rights and hired me to write the script. And that's how my television and movie screenwriting career was born. I never saw a penny from those best-selling books that I wrote, even because the publishing company went out of business before my first royalty check was due.
Oh, no.
So I have the oil painting that was used for the four covers of the book. They only changed the bottom of the oil painting. I bought this years later from the artist. But I ended up, that launched my TV career, and I ended up doing, hundreds and hundreds of episodes of television, writing and producing shows like Diagnosis Murder and Spencer for Hire and Baywatch and The New Adventures of Flipper, Sequest. I mean, a million shows. And I'm still doing it today. I have a series premiering in just a week or so called You're Killing Me, starring Brooke Shields. It's a lighthearted mystery series on Acorn and AMC Plus. But I ended up, still dabbling in books. And to date, I think I've written 70 novels.
Yeah, your list is quite extensive, for both shows and novels. That is quite the origin story. You are correct.
Well, I left out a bunch of stuff. I mean, like when the books didn't pay me anything and the movie never happened, I ended up supporting myself as a freelance writer. And I wrote for all kinds of magazines and newspapers. I even worked for Playgirl writing fake letters to the editor that I then answered, for their sexual advice column.
Incredible.
Because I had a
Nice.
girlfriend who was an editor at that magazine. So, I mean, I've done all kinds. They paid me like $30 a letter. It was great. It was a
Wow.
great
Well,
learning experience, learning to write in different voices and
yeah.
write badly about sex. And then, eventually, I ended up writing more books and getting into TV and film. But it was not an immediate jump from the vigilante movie that never happened to their career. And I'm compressing time, but I did a lot of different kinds of writing before I found my niche.
So that's, really interesting because I think that, sometimes changing genres or different mediums can sometimes, be easier or better for your writing and sometimes not. But do you find, has your process changed and all that, or do you have different processes depending on, whether you're writing a show, whether you're writing a book? Like, how do you kind of juggle all of that?
Well, writing a script is very different than writing a novel. They're two very different ways of telling a story. They're two very different mediums, and how you go about them is very different. In television, and you work with a writer's room. You work with a whole bunch of other writers. You're doing an episode every week. You have set characters. You have shooting schedules and budgets and all kinds of things that impact the way you write. And a screenplay is more like a blueprint for a house. It's a document used by a lot of other people to do their jobs. It's not something you read to entertain someone, though that's part of it. It's really more to tell people how to do their jobs. Here's where we need to go. Here are the actors we need to have. Here's the sets we need to build. Here's the wardrobe we're going to need. Here are the special effects. It's a working document. And the way you tell a story in film is through dialogue and action. If you don't see it and hear it, it doesn't exist. It's very different than a book where you are the director, the actor, the set decorator, you're everybody, and you can get inside people's heads. And the way you tell a story is very different. You don't have to just show and tell. You can do a deep background, multiple points of view. You can do all kinds of things that you can't do in a television episode or a movie. Plus, you have a limited amount of time in a movie or a TV show to tell your story. You can write thousands of pages if you want in a book. No one will buy it, but you can do it.
Right, you can do it.
But as far as whether my process has changed in television, no. The process there is pretty baked into the industry and medium itself. But as far as books go, yes, my process has changed dramatically. What I do now is I write the book, my books, as scripts first, not with any intention of
Oh,
selling them to movies or
interesting.
television. I do it to get the story out as fast as I can, to get it out on paper while it's still fresh in my head. And using the techniques of television, using showing and not telling, driving a story through action and dialogue. And in those places where I can't, I put a note to myself, boring forensic stuff here, or
Right.
describe
Yeah.
room there. But I do that just to get the rhythm and pace of the story and to get it out in a few weeks. And then I end up novelizing my own scripts. So I've done the writing in the sense of the dialogue and the story, and now I'm just coloring between the lines. I'm fixing it. And that's my process now. And I think that's what gives my books a momentum and an energy that makes it feel like you're watching a TV show or a movie when you're reading my books. I want my authorial voice, with the exception of my new book, Murder by Design, I want my authorial voice to disappear because usually I write books in the third person. Murder by Design is written in the first person. So the authorial voice is the book, and it's very different from the other kinds of writing that I do, where I try to stay out of the way as an author and just let the characters drive the story and do all the talking and do all the action. Now, with Murder by Design, I'm framing it to the point of view of a delusional and unreliable narrator.
Yes, which was a lot of fun. And I can definitely see how, when I read it, you know, you can feel sort of the, I don't want to say you can feel the screenplay elements of it, but you can definitely, it felt like reading a show, not like reading a screenplay, but like reading a show. I don't know if that makes sense,
well,
but it was very fast paced and fun.
What I'm trying to do, and it's a lesson I learned from working with Janet Ivanovich, is I think if, no, it doesn't apply to Murder by Design, because as I said, that's first person. But in most of my writing, I want my writing to disappear so you forget you're reading a book. And you get so caught up in it that it's just a movie playing in your head. So if I write something clever in the description, it pulls you out and says, oh, that's writing, look at me. I don't want to do that. If I have something clever to say, I put it in a character's mouth or a character's mind so you don't notice the reading that you're doing. It doesn't pull you out. I'm not trying to impress you with my way with words, with flowery descriptions and great metaphors and that kind of thing in the prose. With a first person story, I want it to feel like you're listening to a good friend tell you something that happened to him or her. So in the, like when I wrote the 15 Monk novels, they're from the point of view of Monk's assistant. And it was like Monk's assistant sharing with you, working with this crazy person and how she tried to survive dealing with it. And here, you're kind of listening to a crazy person. It's not that Wally Nash, aspiring actor, is crazy, but he is an actor. He's a little bit, not a little unhinged himself, trying to help an unhinged individual. And there, the authorial voice is what's carrying it.
Yeah.
It's you're listening to somebody on the phone in a way, or it's almost like an audiobook, but you're reading it.
Yeah.
And that's what I'm going for.
Yeah. It definitely felt like that. It was very easy to feel like, you know, Wally is telling you this outlandish story, which I think, you know, made it a lot of fun to read. Like, you know, you kind of have two, not necessarily unreliable characters, but definitely they have interesting perspectives, Wally and Bixby. You know, where did the idea for those two particular characters and the book, and then the decision to write it in first person, like how did that all come to fruition?
It all came from one line I read years ago. I don't remember where. I'm going to probably mispronounce this gentleman's name. Famous architect and art critic and architecture professor Bernard Tashumi had a quote that said, to truly understand architecture, you need to commit a murder. And he talked about how design makes murder and other crimes possible, even inevitable.
Interesting.
And I became fascinated by that. And I started reading tons and tons of books and articles about the whole world of design, not just the design of buildings, but landscape design and the design of devices, and how we now are so separated from the natural world that we live within the built world, a world that man has created to adapt nature to our needs. But more importantly, that man has built to shape and force and constrain and determine our behavior. And we're blind to it. We're oblivious to it. And yet we live in it 95% of the time. I mean, everything we do is directed by some kind of design. And I thought it'd be a really cool way to, if I could find a way to use design to solve crimes, to do it kind of backwards. Instead of looking at the body on the ground, look at the environment around it and how that body could have gotten on the ground and how that murder could have been committed or preordained by the circumstances. How'd that person get there? Why there? What was used to kill them? And I mean, just every device we use, every tool we use is designed for a function that can be subverted or used for something else. And the more I thought about it, I there's got to be a way to do this. And how do I come up with a character that would embody this, that wouldn't be boring and pedantic? And, you know, I've written a lot of police procedurals and I enjoy them very much, but I was kind of itching to get back to Monk. You know, I wrote 15 Monk novels and a whole bunch of Monk episodes, and I didn't want to do necessarily Monk again, but my own version of Monk, Hercule Poirot, Nero Wolfe, Sherlock Holmes, but without going through all those old tropes. But what if there was a way I could do it, serve those tropes, and also subvert them, make fun of them, do them in a new way, and do it in a way that acknowledges what the readers have read, where the characters know about Monk and Nero Wolfe and Sherlock Holmes and how they're fitting into that cliche and paradigm. And the character just kind of evolved. I mean, Edison Bixby is an outlandish character, but he's very different from other similar eccentric detectives. Edison Bixby grew up with two designers as parents, an inventor and a woman who designed sets for movies and amusement parks and stuff. So design was always part of his language at home. And his parents are killed in a freak accident that he determines is not an accident. And as a very young man, becomes through legal settlements, becomes insanely rich, becomes a detective. And unlike all these other, and pardon me for being crude, all these other detectives who can't get laid, he has a wonderful sex life. I mean, this man, Nero Wolfe was too damn fat and a recluse. You know, he never had any relationships. Sherlock Holmes, cocaine addict. The only time he had a relationship was with another, you know, crazy woman. Monk, of course, had no relationships. You look at all of them. All Hercule Poirot, who knows what he was, gay or straight or...
We don't know.
You know, celibate. But you know, they never had any lives, and they're always like, not that attractive. I wanted to have like the world's most attractive, wealthy, socially adept guy, and then give him a handicap. So I had him shot in the face in the opening pages of my book, and he has a traumatic brain injury that makes it difficult for him to censor his thoughts. He says exactly what's on his mind, which gets him into a lot of trouble. So he needs an assistant to kind of stop him from being sued constantly and offending everybody he meets. And that's where Wally Nash, aspiring actor, comes in. And I got the idea for Wally from, I believe it was a book by Paco Underhill. It was a book by a sociologist who talked about how he doesn't hire graduate students and other aspiring scientists to be his field researchers because they always apply science to what they're observing. He likes to hire artists, writers, singers, actors, people who understand human behavior, who are empathized with people and are not trying to prove a theory, but can try to understand what motivates a person to do something. And I thought, okay, I like that idea. And that's why I came up with an actor to be Bixby's assistant. And then why first person? Because I think the best way to explore an eccentric character is not to be in an eccentric character's mind, but to be outside it trying to interpret it, to have a stand-in for the audience, like Watson with Sherlock Holmes or Archie with Nero Wolfe or Natalie and Sharona with Monk. I mean, all these eccentric detectives have a hapless assistant. But I want my assistant to be kind of different too, have aspirations of his own. And it's allowed me to have fun with the genre and to have to joke about it while at the same time servicing it.
Yeah, it was definitely a lot of fun. You know, I mean, Wally is not as eccentric as Bixby, but he's still eccentric in his own way. Like the two of them, very fun. What surprised you the most while you were writing this book?
How hard it was. I mean, I was hating myself the whole time I was writing it because doing these design-based mysteries requires so much research. And then I have to find a way to distill it that's entertaining, that doesn't sound like a scientific study, that doesn't sound hard to grasp, that sounds almost natural, that sounds fun, that doesn't sound expositional. And that takes a lot of work. I mean, Wally helps because Wally's not a scientist, so he's going to see it in basic ways. And Edison Bixby is too impatient and full of himself to explain himself all that much. So that allowed me some leeway to shorthand things. And I wanted people to rely more on their readers, to rely on their own personal experience out in the world. I mean, all of us have wrestled with trying to understand a hotel room shower. I mean, the shower should be obvious how to use. hot and cold water and water flow. That's it. And they make it so complicated. I just scalded myself in New York on a shower because the dials were in different places of the shower. To sort of turn it on, you had to get hit with the water. There was no way around it. You couldn't figure out what was water flow, what was heat, which was the upper shower, which was the handheld, which was the bathtub. It was, you need an instruction manual. And we've all had that problem. And we encountered doors that are hard to figure out and stovetops we can't operate. And it's just...
That light switch in your house that seems to go to absolutely nothing?
I have in my entry hall, because I didn't build this house, we bought it. Right. There must be 7 light switches. Of those 7, there are probably 3. We have no idea what they do.
Yeah.
We press them and we don't know where they go to. And
no idea.
We've ended up labeling the other 4. Once we figured out what they did, we have our light switches in our kitchen and we have these banks of lights.
Yeah.
Our buttons. We don't know what they do. We think they may have operated stuff outdoors that no longer exist, or it's crazy.
Yeah. Yeah. So including those. Yeah. It's it's a lot of fun. You talked a little bit about, you know, where the idea came from and sort of subverting genres. But I am curious, having written, you know, so much in the procedural, the mystery space, how you know, what's the trick to making sure that the cases are unique and interesting and fresh?
Well, if you go down that route, it's impossible. The way you make it interesting and fresh is you don't start with the case. You don't start with the mystery. You start with the character. You come up with an interesting character and then ask yourself in each book or even on television with each episode, what could I do to put this character in a position where we're going to see new aspects of his or her personality? What kind of conflict can I create that will generate the most emotion and the most humor and challenge the character in ways we haven't seen before, that will reveal interesting things about the character, that will make it memorable? Because I believe people come back not for the mystery, but for the characters. And it's the characters you fall in love with. It's the characters you remember. Yeah, the mystery has to be good, but what makes the mystery good is not how clever it is, but what it means to the protagonist and what it does, how it challenges him or her. And how it creates obstacles for him or her, and how they have to work around that by dealing with their own problems. So in the case of Edison Bixby, I fell in love with these two characters and came up with a mystery I thought would show us how the two of them came together, why they need each other, and show you how Edison Bixby's mind works. Mm-hmm. So in essence, Murder by Design, without revealing anything about the mystery, is all about Edison Bixby. It reveals him in myriad ways. And I'm writing the sequel now, and the same thing. I have to come up with a mystery that is going to tell you some new things about the character and the relationship he has with Wally, and vice versa. Yes, it has to be challenging and amazing, impossible crimes and all that. But it's more about the character. I don't think I can come up with the greatest impossible crime in the world, but if you aren't engaged by the person solving that crime and how it impacts him or her and their own stake in the crime, then no one's going to care.
Yeah, I guess that is true. When I think about, you know, mysteries and what makes them fun, it's not the genius of the crime. It's the detective. How are they going to solve this? And, you know, what obstacles are they going to encounter along the way?
Think about Columbo.
Yeah.
Columbo, we all know who done it. We all know exactly who did it. The fun is in watching Columbo figure out what we already know. So that's why I'm never afraid in my books that the reader is going to solve the crime before the detective. It doesn't matter. As long as they love the detective, if they solve the crime before he does, they'll just feel smart. And I believe in fairly clued mysteries. All my clues are there. So at the end of the book, or even the TV show, you should be able to go back and see the clues you missed and go, oh, God, how did I miss that? It was right in my face. He told me who done it and I missed it, you know, and that's what I try to do, what I aspire to. I really hate mystery books and TV shows that don't share with you the clues, that don't allow you to solve it, which is why I don't like the forensic shows. You know, unless you can analyze blood and sperm in your home and the TV show is going to send you the samples, you can't really solve the crime.
Right. Yeah. So who's been your favorite character to create over your career?
I've written so much that I didn't create. In television, I didn't create Monk. I didn't create Diagnosis Murder. I didn't create Flipper. So those characters I inherited. Probably my favorite character in books that I've created is Eve Ronan, the protagonist of my most successful books. She's constantly surprising me because she's so fallible. She's not perfect. And I know it frustrates readers sometimes. How could she make that mistake? How could she do that? I mean, because she's not Sherlock Holmes. She's not Edison Bixby. She's not a perfect detective. She never will be, but this is her early days, and we're seeing how she becomes. It's like Harry Bosch before Harry Bosch became so confident in his abilities to solve crimes. Doesn't have that confidence. And that's challenging and fun for me to watch her grow and to make mistakes and to put her in situations where she can make gigantic mistakes and do things that make you want to just slap her. I don't believe in perfect heroes. I like heroes that piss off the reader as much as they engage the reader. I'm sure there are many people who read Edison Bixby being sexist and racist because he can't control his thoughts and go, I hate this guy. I want that.
It does make it, particularly to have Wally there sort of reacting in
Yeah.
real
Oh my
time.
God, how could you say that?
It's like I said, it's a very fun dynamic. Gosh, I've just really enjoyed this conversation. You're very fun to talk to. But we like to close the show with the same question that we ask everyone, and that is, what is one piece of advice you would give new or aspiring writers?
Read lots of books. And if you find yourself crying, or you find yourself, your heart racing, or you find yourself aroused, or you find yourself sickened, or you find yourself bored, or ask yourself why. If a book excites you, it makes you, your heart's racing, go back and look at how the writer achieved that. And if the book bored you and you're not interested, go back and ask yourself, where was I lost? What mistake did the writer make? The great thing about being a writer and wanting to learn the craft is that the craft is right in front of you. You can see it all. If a book just bowls you over and you love it, go back and deconstruct it. Go through and write the outline down. And then look at the individual scenes and how they worked and try to figure out how did the author evoke that emotion in you with just words on a page? How did the author make you cry? And why did you care so much to cry about something that's just words on a page? And if a book is just terrible, that's also a huge learning experience. So you can study the masters and the god-awful failures and learn so much from them. The best writers read. And I'm always learning from the books I read. I'm still amazed at and I'll read something, oh my God, I wish I could do that. And then try to figure out how that author did it.
Yeah, I think that's fantastic advice. Well, again, thank you for being on the show. This
My
has
pleasure.
been a very fun conversation, and Murder by Design, I think, comes out when we air this, so today. Lee was so much fun to talk to. I hope he was as much fun to listen to. He's a riot.
My big takeaway from this whole conversation, when he started talking about the light switches in his foyer, I've got four in our mudroom that I still don't know to this day what they go to. Like, we completely gutted the house, we renovated everything. They're live wires, so we know they do something, but we have yet to figure out what they are.
Every house has that. It's
Oh yeah, we
like
have. I'm pretty sure it's to an outdoor light, but I don't know what it
you're
is.
like,
Probably.
I don't know. It's
Oh yeah.
so now we need a mystery about that. Like, where at what point does it go
No
from
light
this, we
switch.
know where this goes, to like, who knows what this is?
That, I don't know. Yeah, like our fuse box is labeled from when we moved in too, and there are some that are just not labeled. And I'm like,
What do
I don't know
they
what
go to?
that
We
is.
don't know. Yeah. Oh well, yeah, there were a lot of interesting things.
There's just one fuse in there that's marked Bob. No one knows what it does, but every time you flip it, there's people screaming.
It shifts dimensions. It just puts you
That's
in a
it.
new timeline. What
Yeah.
show would you want to write for?
Oh, that's hard.
What? Really?
Every show he mentioned is one I would have wanted to write for. I would have wanted to write for Monk, for sure.
Monk would have been fun. What about Flipper, though? I remember Flipper when I was a kid.
I was like Flipper.
I'd write for Flipper.
True. That would be great.
I think you need a crossover like Flipper and Sequest.
With Monk
on the submarine.
Flipper and Monk.
Flipper and Monk solving
Flipper's
crime.
Long dead.
Well.
Flipper is like Benji. Like Benji's been around forever. Flipper will be around forever.
It's a Shamu, right? They just keep renaming the new whales.
Yep.
They rename the new
it's
Flipper.
Like, it's like when the hamster dies, you never really know.
That's right. Yeah.
That's true. We have.
I wonder how many people in the audience we just lost by talking about Benji and Flipper.
Probably both of them.
What are these things?
Go look. Have some nice nostalgia watches on YouTube. Maybe they're AI.
I mean, my big takeaway from all this is this guy was juggling a lot of stuff and he was doing it very well.
Yeah.
If you read any of his books, like they're phenomenal. They're really funny. They're very well crafted, well put together. And meanwhile, he's working on all these TV shows at the same time, which is a totally different world. I do get why he would write a screenplay first and then turn that into a book, especially if you're coming out of that. That makes a lot of sense.
I actually thought that that was a smart idea. And, you know, if you have read his books, like particularly this one, like when he said that, I was like, oh, I can actually see that, because it was very structured. But also his writing is like, it was very easy to like play in my head, you know, like as you're reading it, like it was like very visual, very I don't know if maybe that's because I do have familiarity with LA, and he nails like a lot of not just like the physical descriptions, but just sort of like the aura of Los Angeles.
Well, if you think about it, a screenplay and an outline are kind of similar in a way. I mean, they're like sketchy versions of what you're going to see on screen usually, but you know, so he basically took that and applied it to, you know, I'm going to say basically a screenplay is an outline written in dialogue instead of in scene beats.
So I was going to say that's kind of interesting because, you know, he starts with character, which I know a lot of us do, but the way he starts with character, because it's that screenplay, I think is like a really, like he gets the voice through the dialogue, through the character, and just like sort of those, and then flushes it out with a description. I don't know. I thought that made a lot of sense. It was very interesting. And I think if you want to write visually, that might be a fun exercise to do, to see how that changes your
writing.
It's
a great way to keep the book in the moment. You know, if you're having trouble writing a book that, you know, like Patterson's always beaten into my head, be there in that scene. And this is a great way to do that. And if you tend to be very heavy on exposition, descriptions, those types of things, this is a much better starting place. I actually made Jay Thorne, we all remember Jay. I made him write an entire dialogue only manuscript at one point, because he was really big on exposition. And like, I kept dropping out of the story because it just got so heavy. I was like, just write it all with nothing but dialogue, go back in and fill the blanks, you know, which was a, you know, kind of the same thing. But at the end of the day, I mean, all this guy's really doing is outlining. You know, he's creating that framework before he writes the book.
Plus, bonus, he's got something he can peddle afterward.
There's a lot of people in Hollywood, you know, when those strikes hit, you know, there were screenwriters working in that world that turned around and wrote a novel. And now I think a lot of them are doing both. And like when you can go out into that world and you've got both, you know, you've got a screenplay you can hold up, you've got a novel that's out there selling, that's a huge leg up, you know, especially right now when all these studios and producers, everybody's trying to save some money.
Yeah. I do think he was right when he was saying, though, people read mysteries for the characters and not necessarily the case. I mean, I was thinking about that and I'm like, half the times I don't even remember what the case was about.
What the actual case
necessarily,
was.
Necessarily, but I remember the characters. Yeah.
It's like suddenly the character, you know, solves the mystery and you're like, oh yeah, there was a mystery.
There was a mystery.
There was a body.
Yeah. He's very good at keeping, I mean, you're very aware of what he's doing. Like it's a very like tightly focused book, but it is very much through the eyes of the character. So I liked that a lot. Particularly the design.
Yeah, like that was really interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. He mentioned a few books like at the end in the author note. And I thought, like, oh, that has, yeah, again, talking about light switches, but like, he brings up light switches in the book. It was really funny. Yeah, but yeah, like how things are designed and using that as a way to sort of like triangulate clues and like, oh, the person had to be standing here and doing this, which is sort of very Dexter without the blood. Like it was really interesting. And how he focused on that for a long time and kind of it bubbled up when the time was right. What's the most unusual place in an idea for either a book or a character has sprung up for you? Like
Like
design.
where the idea came to us or where we set the idea.
Like he used design, so like that's kind of an unusual thing that he stumbled across and then put it into a book.
I just published, it's coming out on the 16th, a book about a serial killer who uses deep fakes to replace his victims and keep them alive online so that it skews when, it skews their time of death. Does that
Oh.
count? Or is that just a blatant plug on my part?
Well, it could maybe
Little bit
both.
of both.
It could be, yeah. Let's
Two
not.
things can be true.
Yeah.
That's Echo coming out June 16th.
Oh.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe that's kind of a hard question. I guess those ideas, sometimes it's hard to figure out where they come from. They just like pop in your head at 2 a.m. and you're
Oh,
like,
one started because I was watching
yeah.
Formula One and I was like, it would be really cool if Formula One was in a Mad Max world. I don't know. Like,
That is really cool.
that
Oh,
was.
that's like,
Well,
what was that
isn't
one that
there
you just
there's
read?
a movie called Death Race, I think. Wasn't there a movie called
Oh, yeah,
Death
that was
Race,
like
which
in
was
the
basically
60s? There's a few of them.
'60s. Wasn't that like
No,
in the '50s?
they remade
Yeah.
it.
Oh, they
There's
remade it?
one probably maybe 10 years old. They did, I
Yeah.
think, two or three of them. They redid the whole.
Not to deter you from writing your F1,
Oh,
an
it's in a
apocalypse
drawer. It's
book,
probably not
but
coming out. I already wrote it, and then I was like, yeah, So we'll
revamp
see.
it. Put it
Polish
in a
it, get it out
screenplay
there.
and
we'll see. One day.
punch it up.
I do love Formula One anyway.
Yeah, you just read
Okay.
a book about that.
Yeah.
What was that? The Regency
Oh, The Fast and
carriage.
the Fastidious. Yeah, that's kind of why I was like, oh, I'll read this. Well, I love like that kind of
Yeah.
stuff, so that was fun.
That's funny.
Yeah. Okay, but you didn't answer, Jenna. What, who do you want to write for? I thought of my answer. I think if they bring Lucifer back, I'd like to write for Lucifer. That would be super fun.
Ooh, that would be
It's
good.
like supernatural and like
Ooh, I'd like to
pop
write
stuff.
another
I
version
love
of
it.
Moonlighting.
There you go.
Oh,
Ooh,
that's
yeah.
very you. You know, Kevin, he's, I don't write romance. Moonlighting,
They hated each other.
We all know Kevin writes romance under a secret pen name that he won't disclose to us.
That was the
That
original
I have
enemies
not
to
yet
lovers.
disclosed. Yeah.
I'd want to write for Hannibal.
Ooh, bring me two.
Yeah. Or X-Files.
Hi,
X-Files would
Mads,
be a
call
lot of
me.
fun. Like,
X-Files is coming back, so you got a shot.
with David Duchovny?
No, all new cast.
Well, then it's not X-Files, is it?
Yeah.
Who knows? I don't know if they're going to show up or not, but they're not on the show. They're not cast members, I guess.
Is that for real? I thought you were just making that up.
That's for real. No, that's a real thing. Yeah, the X-Files is in production right now. They got a new cast and they're bringing it back.
Yeah.
I would totally write an episode of X-Files. I could probably make that happen. I need to make some phone calls.
Ooh,
bring us with
Dave's
you.
Yeah. We should tag team on that.
I love those kind of shows. I love, if you remember Outer Limits, that was one of my
Oh, I
favorites,
love that
especially when
show
Showtime
too.
redid it.
Yeah, that was
Twilight
awesome.
Zone,
Yeah.
and any of those I would probably like to do.
Yeah.
Showtime's Outer Limits to me is the benchmark of that kind of show. I always thought
Yeah.
that because there's one episode in particular that has stuck with me all these years. I'm not going to talk about it, but that was re really well done.
The beautiful lady in the pig episode still haunts me. So, that was from Twilight Zone, I think. So, now my face. Okay. On that note, JD, who's up next week?
Next week, we've got Carolyn Kepnes coming back on. Carolyn's the New York Times bestselling author of the highly popular You series, which is books as well as a great show on Netflix, both featuring Joe Goldberg as the lead character. She's back with a prequel called You First, which is releasing June 9th. So, Carolyn Kepnes.
Yeah, sounds great. If you'd like to be notified as soon as new episodes publish, make sure you go to writersinkpodcast.com and sign up now. We'll see you next episode and have a great week of writing.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Writers, Inc. Access the show notes and leave a comment at writersincpodcast.com.